You know those meetings you go to where nothing happens? A bunch of people sit around a table, nothing gets done? Why do you keep going to those anyway? A question for corporate America today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. Tuesday, the 15th of August. Good as always to have you along, everybody. President Trump had some infrastructure meetings today in Trump Tower in New York. He came down to the lobby afterward, announced a bunch of new ways he is going to get rid of red tape, and then he decided to take some questions, the very first of which was about all the CEOs leaving his manufacturing council.
Why do you think these CEOs are leaving your manufacturing council?
Because they're not taking their job seriously as it pertains to this country. We want jobs, manufacturing in this country. If you look at some of those people that you're talking about, they're outside of the country. They're having a lot of their product made outside. If you look at Merck as an example.
All right, let's hold it right there, shall we? Here's Kenneth Frazier. He is the CEO of Merck, who announced yesterday he is leaving the council. Here he is, Mr. Frazier, back in January at the first and so far only meeting of that group.
And we have tremendous numbers of high-paying, high-skilled jobs, including manufacturing jobs in the United States. And in fact, we're bringing manufacturing back for our cancer drug.
What you can't see, because this is radio, obviously, is that the president is nodding along as Frazier and the other CEOs in the room spoke and said nice things. All right, so back to the president today.
Take a look at where their product is made. It's made outside of our country. We want products made in the country. Now, I have to tell you, some of the folks that will leave, they're leaving out of embarrassment because they make their products outside. And I've been lecturing them, including the gentleman that you're referring to, about you have to bring it back to this country.
Quick thing here for the record. Merck, according to its website, has invested $1 billion over the past decade in manufacturing operations in this country. So far, five CEOs have left the manufacturing council the past 2 days. Under Armour, Intel, the head of the Alliance for American Manufacturing. Also today, Richard Trumka of the AFL-CIO, as well as Mr. Frazier from before. But bigger picture, if you're the CEO of a major American company and you agreed, I don't know, 7, 8 months ago to be on this or any White House council, why do you stay? We asked Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman to suss that one out.
Why do CEOs join presidential commissions in the first place? After all, they're busy people. The gig involves travel, meetings with a lot of important people who all want to talk. You got to dress as well as the CEO sitting next to you.
Presidential commissions are ceremonial. It's kind of like a merit badge, if you will, for a CEO to be part of a group like this.
Mark Cohen directs retail studies at Columbia University, and he says participating brings prestige and visibility. And also access, says John Palizza, a former top executive at Walgreens and retired business professor.
A lot of money is thrown at lobbying Washington, being on a presidential council. It never guarantees that your policies are going to get carried out, but you'll be heard before anybody else.
Except this president has the loudest voice on the political landscape, says analyst Norm Orenstein at the American Enterprise Institute. He says more and more CEOs are finding that prestige and access is outweighed by being associated with an administration frequently accused of indifference to racism.
Identifying with the president in this way was going to identify them with bad things that could damage their businesses and their reputations.
Of course, the CEOs who remain have policy goals they want to achieve, like corporate tax cuts, immigration, and health care reform. Quitting the Manufacturing Council and getting angry tweets from President Trump for leaving could hurt all that. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Retail got a small piece of good news today in the form of July data that came in better than the experts had been guessing. According to the good people at the Commerce Department, retail sales were up 0.6% over June, 4% better than this time last year. Not bad for an industry where there has been some angst of late. What's really interesting, though, as Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explains, is what is driving some of July's growth.
Here's the very first thing I heard from the very first person I called this morning to talk about this new data.
A lot of consumers, they came out swinging.
Wait for it.
But in addition, this is the third year running that we have Amazon Prime Day, approximately in the middle of the July, and the online sales are doing very, very well.
That's Chris Christopher with IHS Market. He says Amazon's big 30-hour sale sucks up a lot of buying into July that would normally happen in August. Non-store retailers were up 1.3% in July. But really, Amazon Prime Day is affecting national economic data?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's kind of like the Black Friday of July. This year, most major retailers piggybacked on this and had their own major online sales.
That was Craig Rowley at Korn Ferry. He cautions against overstating Amazon's effect. Amazon has a big share of online sales, but the total retail landscape is still huge. So set retail aside for a minute. Brian Witcher is with Forrester Research.
Today, Amazon is more like a company like GE than it is like a company like Macy's. They have multiple arms of their business that compete with multiple different industries.
Cloud services, food and grocery, entertainment, logistics, and all those industries feel Amazon coming for them. Bloomberg recently analyzed the transcripts of 90 days of earnings calls and other corporate events. They found Amazon was mentioned more than 600 times. President Trump, meanwhile, came up just 160 times. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
According to a tally by the Washington Post and the Partnership for Public Service, President Trump has nominated people to fill just 106 of 577 key Senate confirmable jobs in his administration. NASA and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration are two of the agencies still lacking permanent leadership. Marketplace's Jed Kim went out to find out what's at stake for science without somebody in charge and what's at stake if somebody is.
To be clear, even with no administrator at NOAA, the agency is still able to do its basic work, warning us about hurricanes and other impending weather disasters. David Titley teaches meteorology at Penn State. He likens the current situation to a ship.
Steaming on a course through the night, there are people on the bridge to make sure that they don't hit anything, that it's safe. But there's nobody sort of in the captain's chair to say, hey, we may need to go on a different course.
Not having a new captain means there's no new agenda, and that's a mixed blessing to some. Andrew Rosenberg is with the Union of Concerned Scientists. He says temporary leadership makes agencies less effective, but an appointed ideologue can wreak havoc.
What I would like to have is appointees who really understand and have the mission of the agency to heart. I'm not sure that's a Trump appointee, given the appointments that have been made in a number of agencies.
Like he says, the EPA, headed by Scott Pruitt, who's sued the agency in the past. Ellen Stofan is the former chief scientist for NASA. She says businesses need strong government science.
They want decisions to be made based on the best information, whether it's the best drug research, the best agricultural research, the best research for science and technology.
In the meantime, it's up to career professionals within agencies to keep their heads down and rowing. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
Wall Street Today investors were pretty much treading water from opening bell to the close. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Donald Trump spent a lot of time on economic themes during his campaign. Not a lot of specifics, but in general, we heard about infrastructure and immigration and healthcare, of course, economy-related, all of them. The biggie, though, the very heart of Trump's economic policies then and now is globalization and how the United States, in a nutshell, ought to be doing less of it. No Trans-Pacific Partnership, maybe no NAFTA, more trade barriers and higher tariffs. But you know what? There are plenty of people out there who believe in globalization. Real people. I mean, beyond politicians and academics. They believe in it because they're living it. You can find some of them at a German beer garden called Hans and Franz. Lots of long outdoor tables, people grabbing a beer after work. Ollie Berkeley's on a five-week contract at the biggest BMW factory in the world.
For me, globalization is not negative. Yeah, it's positive. Because you can go wherever you want, yeah. Also for your job. So it's much more easier, yeah, than, let's say, 20, 30 years ago. Yeah.
That's about what you'd expect to hear, right? Coming from a German who lives in the European Union and works all over the world. The thing is, this German beer garden we're sitting in, Hans and Franz, It's in an old textile mill on Highway 14 in Greer, South Carolina, the upstate, as it's called. And that BMW factory, the biggest plant that the company has, is just up the road. Here's the point. The very idea that it makes economic sense to make a luxury German car in upstate South Carolina for export to the rest of the world using Americans who used to work in textile factories to do it is what people are talking about when they say globalization can be good for the American economy. So that's what we're looking at today as part of our series on the realities of who's won and who's lost with global trade. It's called Trade-Off. You ask people around South Carolina about globalization, and they say it's pretty obvious.
These cars are sold all over the world, so we are a big part of the global economy. I don't think we can turn back the clock and close the borders.
We have tons of international companies that have come to the Spartanburg and Greenville area.
We used to be all about textile mills, which was very local, which was very organic, and it was, you know, based on what the community built on their backs. We're still doing the same thing. It's just we're willing to reach across the ocean or reach across the border and say, hey, come work with us, and we can both win.
That was Nancy Fitzer, Mallory Sinclair, and Lisa Wells. I talked to them at Coffee Underground in Greenville, a quick 10 miles or so from the Hans and Franz. It's part of this whole corridor of economic development the BMW brought with it. About 30,000 jobs, all told, between the plant and its suppliers. Statewide, unemployment here is below the national average, a flat 4% in June. And that is a fact not lost on South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham, who was in Greer not too long ago to celebrate the 25th anniversary of the original announcement that BMW was coming to town.
To those who fear globalization, embrace it because it's not going away. If you are looking for an example of how globalization can be a net positive for the American people, come to South Carolina.
Yeah, he was probably talking to the president, but we took him up on the offer all the same. Tomorrow we are going to go inside that BMW factory and meet a family that's got two generations working there. But it's worth taking a minute first to explain how it came to be that this corner of South Carolina is now a key part of the global economy, a state, for what it's worth, where Donald Trump, who, remember, ran and won by saying globalization isn't working for Americans, he got 55% of the vote.
I have to tell you, coming from L.A., this humidity is killing us.
I'm a runner, so I'll start sweating in a heartbeat.
David Britt and I are sitting outside the Little River Coffee Bar in downtown Spartanburg, the other end of that BMW corridor from Greenville.
Wade Inns, BMW board, pick Spartanburg, Saturday, June 20th.
We're leafing through a 2-inch-thick stack of newspaper clippings he's been saving for 25 years. It's a well-worn file folder of the news that BMW had picked South Carolina.
Yeah, the dream becomes a reality.
So the initial investment, $645 million in South Carolina, a source inside the company said, good to them for the Herald Journal for breaking this a couple of days early.
Yeah, they did.
Right?
As we sit right across from their offices now.
Britt's been on the Spartanburg County Council since before BMW made its big announcement.
Do you remember the day, 22nd of June, 1992?
I remember every day for about 3 or 4 weeks during there. Yes, it was just amazing relief, satisfaction, and you know, it's almost like being found in an ocean when you're out in the ocean by yourself with no life preserver. You're falling overboard and you're just hoping somebody's going to come and save you. That's a feeling, oh my goodness, just being saved.
Saved because he knew there was a big problem coming. Textile manufacturing, the main industry here for decades and decades, was going away.
In the 70s, when companies were moving offshore, whether it was, you know, to China, Vietnam, or, you know, India, Mexico, It took this community by surprise, and it was a stomach punch like you've never seen. We had 25,000 employees lose their jobs in about 10, 12 years. This downtown was decimated. We didn't know where to turn.
I'm going to take a beat here to let that sink in. The textile industry that this town was built on left because of globalization, because it made more economic sense to move that production and those jobs someplace else. And really, people here might have been justified in throwing in the globalization towel. Instead, they fought to get more of it.
And as they whittled it down, it came down between Omaha, Nebraska, and Anderson, South Carolina. So we went hard at work. We matched their incentives, but we had a couple things working for us.
So besides those tax incentives and the fact that South Carolina is a right-to-work state, they had experienced workers from the fading textile industry ready to go. There's an airport, which makes it easy to fly in those German engines, the only parts of the car that aren't made here, by the way. There was plenty of land, and South Carolina has a port, the port of Charleston, not too far away, which means easy access to the rest of the global car market. And that all changed everything.
It's not just Spartanburg. It's not South Carolina. It's not the United States. We are an international community, and you're either going to play in the international market or you're not.
What do you say to the parts of the country, though, that aren't feeling what South Carolina's feeling?
Come here and listen. Now, we have communities that come here. You know, you got to open your eyes. We were fortunate. It was a blessing that BMW came here. That helped us understand the international community and also opportunities. Just see what's happened to us in 25 years.
This is the theory of globalization in real life. Landing BMW meant South Carolina has been able to grow its own mini auto industry, kind of a multiplier effect. And that's why and how David Britt, sitting there talking to me in front of the cafe, looks around downtown Spartanburg and he sees the global economy.
Since that day, we now landed Volvo, Mercedes. They do the Mercedes vans right here in the upstate. And all the other automotive manufacturing facilities that are in Tennessee, Alabama, those suppliers, they've landed here. Because that rising tide floats all boats.
It's that perspective that puts this area, again, in a state that voted for him, at economic odds with President Trump.
Do you just discount what's coming out of the White House then?
I think there's a lack of understanding. And I think the president will come down, and I think he will see what's happened here. I invite him to come to Spartanburg. I can let him stay at my house if he'd like to. Come on down. But I'd love for him to see what BMW and all the other international companies have meant to us. I say to the president and his staff, you guys deal with the countries. I believe in fair trade. I believe these countries that don't treat us fairly need to treat us fairly. But by the same token, you guys deal with the countries, let us deal with the companies.
The politics of the global economy, of course, aren't that easy, no matter what the president or Senator Graham or anybody says. Tomorrow, we are going to go inside that BMW factory and see what happens once you decide globalization maybe isn't going to be all that bad. If you want more of our trade-off series before then, we've got a video up with more about the winners and losers of globalization. You can check it out at marketplace.org. Coming up.
Well, it's this kind of secret pumpkin cabal, in a way.
This just in, pumpkin pie isn't really pumpkin. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 5 today, barely changed, 21,998. NASDAQ down 7, we'll call that a 10th, 63.33. S&P 500 off 1, 24.64. Home improvement stocks took a hit today. Lowe's dipped 4.4%. Home Depot hammered down 2.6%. Sports retailers took a hit as well. Foot Locker stepped down 4.4%. Dick's Sporting Goods down 23% on weak second quarter results. Bond prices, well, they fell too. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.27%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is My Economy Time, our series where we ask you how you're feeling in your economic day-to-day. Today's installment looks ahead to the start of NAFTA renegotiations tomorrow, specifically the wine and spirits discussion.
This is Javier Martinez, CEO of Martinez Brands, which is importing and wholesale wines and spirits from Mexico mainly. My advice would be for the Mexican negotiators to be strong. You know, we don't want to kill this agreement because it has been beneficial for the three parties, Mexico, U.S. and Canada. Be strong, you know. Do not give up on stupid things like tariffs because it will damage the commerce between the two countries. So be strong, be firm. My view right now is that there is a strong demand for Mexican products in the U.S. Tequila is growing at 6% every year. Mezcal is growing double digits. Even if you kill NAFTA and you'll have to impose and go by the rules of the World Trade Organization, last case scenario, the U.S. imposes a tariff. That will affect, obviously, the price and eventually the demand, but not to the point of killing the commerce between the two countries. The Mexican producers already have the American interest defending NAFTA, the commerce between the two countries. And they have actually, for the first time in so many years, coordinated a strategy. So something that we didn't have, you know, 7 months or 8 months ago when we start talking about, you know, this issue. This time, you know, allow us to coordinate, okay, what is your interest in Mexico and how do they connect with the interest within the United States? That is happening right now. We are, I think both sides are well prepared to fight the fight.
Dr. Javier Martinez there, the CEO of Martinez Brands there in Pasadena, California. Do take a minute. If you would send us your story, there's a place you can do that at marketplace.org/myeconomy. All right. Just because sometimes we all need a break from the news of the day, we turn now to dessert. A dessert cookbook specifically, which along with recipes tells the story of how some of the most iconic treats that we know came to be so popular. Spoiler alert, a lot of times it's because a company made it happen. The book is called The Brave Tart, Iconic American Desserts by Stella Parks. She was also the senior editor at Serious Eats. Stella, thanks for coming on the program.
It's great to be here.
So this is an awesome book because there's all kinds of fun stuff in it. And were I a better baker, I would make some of it. But it's a little bit depressing, too, because there's a whole lot of like corporate and branding and marketing and all that stuff behind all these treats that we know and love in this country.
That's not depressing.
Oh, okay. It was depressing for me.
No, I think it's like a fantastic part of American culture, the way these desserts kind of are disseminated across the country thanks to these marketing efforts and corporations.
So give me. We'll do a couple of examples here. The first one up, talk to me about pumpkin pie for a minute, would you?
I wondered if you'd bring that up.
I know you're not a fan of pumpkin pie. I think pumpkin pie is overrated.
I think that's fair for people to, I mean, know what they like. I think you've probably experienced the fact that you say, I don't like pumpkin pie, and people are like, well, you haven't had my grandma's pumpkin pie.
Okay. Or,
you know, so like that's, pumpkin pie can have a lot of bad things going for it, so it's not unreasonable that you haven't enjoyed it.
Give me the, totally fair enough. Give me the corporate story, of how we got to where pumpkin pie is this staple in this economy now.
Well, it's this kind of secret pumpkin cabal in a way.
And other phrases that have never been said on Marketplace.
Right. So pumpkins are not actually very good for pie. And everyone knows this. Back in the day, everyone enjoyed squash a lot more as like a butternut squash or a winter squash. And so there was this guy who was like this kind of squash king, and he was like into kind of consolidating different squashes and squash research and growing different varietals of squash. And he just, like, snapped up this packing plant and was able to, like, kind of get a monopoly on all the farmers in a specific area of America, which is now Libby's Pumpkin, which is secretly squash.
Yeah, but if I go to the store and I buy a can of pumpkin, it says on the outside 100% pumpkin.
Yeah. There's no rule about what pumpkins are.
Really?
The Food and Drug Administration has no legal distinctions between pumpkins and squash. They're all in the same botanical family. And it's just kind of a game of semantics. And the FDA was like, it doesn't matter. And it doesn't. I'm pro squash.
I wonder how many people listening to this interview, of which I am one, I will tell you, thought it actually was pumpkin that came glopping out of the can.
Yeah, it's totally not pumpkin.
That's mildly horrifying. All right. So to prove that I am not a complete dessert Scrooge here, cheesecake. Cheesecake is my go-to. Like at my house on your birthday, you get the dessert you want. Cheesecake is mine.
That's fantastic. Yeah. Cheesecake is just, it's dreamy. It's pretty great.
And yet there is a corporate story behind this now, my favorite dessert here.
So the story behind cheesecake comes down to cream cheese, which was in the 1800s a really unique regional product to Pennsylvania. But it was also really popular in New York because New York farmers, they would skim it. So it just didn't have that same luxurious sense of a full fat cheese. So this New York-based dairy farmer and his marketing partner decided just to start selling their New York cream cheese as, quote unquote, Philadelphia cream cheese.
Nice.
So, you know, people go to the market, they're not used to advertising, they have no savvy about how to, like, differentiate what these claims truly mean, and they just see this really beautiful package, this thing that says Philadelphia cream cheese, and they're like, perfect, that's exactly what I came here to buy today.
There you go. And I'll tell you, you go to the store today, and it's completely recognizable, and you don't even think. You grab a couple of three, and you go home, and you make whatever you're making. It is a book called Brave Tart. Props on the name, by the way. Brave Tart, Iconic American Desserts by Stella Parks. Stella, thanks very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
This final note on the way out today, and it's a serious question given the president's press conference this afternoon, which if you haven't seen it, I do encourage you to watch. But if you run a major American company, or if you run communications for somebody who does run a big American company, and so in theory you're mindful of brand risk and corporate reputation, and you've heard what the president has been saying about you of late, lecturing you, calling you grandstanders, why do you stay? Are you afraid of mean tweets? Do you really like going to the White House? Do you think you can affect policy by staying? It's an honest-to-Pete serious question. Call me, tweet at me, email me. I am not hard to find. We'll have a conversation, and we'll put it on the radio. All right, we got to go. Wall Street was flat all over the place like it didn't even happen. Tommy Andres is the producer on our special projects desk. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. Our digital team includes Ben Hethcote, Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.